Frame's play Sunday at Sant'Agata, which imagines one unusual evening at Verdi's country retreat when he has some surprise guests. So that's Viva Verdi at 6:30 and Sunday at Sant'Agata at 10 o'clock. And of course, there's a wealth of Verdiana on the iPlayer, so just check out the BBC Radio 3 homepage. I'm James Jolly. Thanks for your company, and I do hope you've enjoyed my choice of music for the past 3 hours. Rob will be back next Sunday with his characteristically eclectic choice of music. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, and my producer today was Neil Miners.
Trust CD Review to tackle the thorniest issues when you're trying to choose which recording to buy.
It's a tricky piece. But what's more, it's a piece with a reputation, and it seems to put even great pianists off.
And building a library guides you to the heart of the music and the finest performances.
A little too chaste for me.
For me, it's not the most moving or beautiful, but we'll come to that later.
Enthusiasm and expertise in the world of classical recordings.
I hope you'll like my recommendations, but I don't expect you to throw away the recordings you love already.
Join me, Andrew McGregor, for CD Review every Saturday morning from 9 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3 and now Private Passions, and Michael's guest this week is the actor Rory Kinnear.
I don't know if you've ever been on the bus and the man next to you, 35-ish, rather familiar, starts singing along, rather loudly, to something he's hearing in his large headphones. Well, look again, it just might be Rory Kinnear. And the reason he would look familiar is because you probably saw him in the most recent Bond movies as MI6 officer Bill Tanner, or on television where he played the journalist in Southcliffe, or seen him in Othello this summer playing an unforgettably chilling Iago. Or you might have been lucky enough to get tickets for his Hamlet at the National. Don't worry if you didn't, because in fact it's being screened at cinemas across the country this week. And it's when you're on your way to the National, Rory Kinnear, to get to the point, that you often sing along to music, isn't it?
Yes, well, I don't live too far away, so it's only about 4 or 5 stops that people would have to put up with my singing. But I tend to find music a great release and way of getting into character and emotion.
Well, we'll be hearing some of the music you sometimes sing later, but I surmise from the music you've chosen that music is something that is quite important to you and that you really think about a lot.
I guess I've always played music from about the age of 4, and I've played trumpet and piano, and I sing as well, and it's always been in the background of my emotional life as well. And periods of trauma or stress have always had an accompanying soundtrack, which I've always tended to use quite medicinally. I guess it's also suffused the work that I do as an actor. I've often found it useful to create characters around music.
So this is a broadcast, an interview that you looked forward to with a little more alacrity than some of the ordinary promotional ones.
It's probably the only interview I've actually run towards rather than away from.
The first piece, you mentioned trumpet, and it is indeed a trumpet concerto. It's not the easiest instrument to learn, is it?
No, and I knew that from many, many years. At the age of 4, my first day at primary school, our headmaster there walked into our class as we were all adjusting to life without our mummies and daddies, and said, we don't have any trumpet players left in the school. Who wants to play the trumpet? And I don't think many people knew what a trumpet was, so our arms remained down. And so he said, OK, I'll have to pick you, you and you. And he handed out these 3 very battered cases to myself and my friend Matt and William, and went home that evening, and my mum and dad looked quite horrified and aghast and said, "What's that?" And I said, I'll play the trumpet now. And from that day on, I played in bands and orchestras, and we all 3 went to the same secondary school, and we all 3 played in bands and orchestras until the age of 18. And the amount of bars rest we must have counted over that period of 14 years as a trumpeter. And it was something I tried to carry on after school, but obviously with life being less regimented, it got more and more difficult. I now find it almost impossible to pick it up for about 5 minutes without feeling a certain degree of agony. But this piece was my one and only triumph as a trumpeter. I was largely, despite the amount of time I played it, nothing more than really, really mediocre at the trumpet. But you could get away with that when you're playing in bands and orchestras because there's usually fellow trumpeters playing with you. The times that I really struggled were when I had to play a solo, whether it be with an orchestra or just by myself. I weirdly don't get nervous as an actor at all. It doesn't even sort of enter my head to get nervous. But as a musician, I found it overwhelming. And then I was asked to play in this concert. I just said to myself, don't get nervous because you'll only muck up. And for some reason, just everything seemed to click. And I seemed to almost enjoy it at points. And I guess I chose this piece to remind myself that when you're relaxed, anything can happen well. And even if you're struggling, there are still glimpses of light and ease that can help you.
So it sounded almost like this. The Andante from Haydn's Trumpet Concerto in E-flat major, Alison Balsam, the solo trumpeter, and the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie of Bremen accompanying her.
Just hearing those first few notes of the trumpet come in that piece, I was transported almost instantly back to that music room where I was playing and the feeling when it started of thinking, This is working, and I have no idea why, but just keep going. And I get that feeling sometimes with acting. There's a story of the actor having given a barnstorming performance, an audience member, a friend, going back to him after the performance and saying, "You were wonderful tonight," and him saying, "I know, but why?" you do get that sense as an actor sometimes of thinking, everything's clicking into place, and I wish I knew why.
You remember you were talking about the expression on your parents' face when you came back with the trumpet in its case. And what's really wonderful is I can slightly conjure up your father's face, because he was such a marvellous actor, Roy Kinnear, really funny. And everything he did came down to a marvellously expressive face. So I can conjure up that look of horror.
He actually grew very fond of my playing the trumpet and really sort of encouraged me. I remember over summer holidays we would practice together. He would sort of be the conductor and I would be playing along, and he'd open the windows and doors and say, "Don't mind about the neighbours, you just blow."
Yeah, and presumably that was one of the tragic circumstances for which you sometimes find music cathartic, because, of course, we were all horrified when he died. He was filming Three Musketeers and came off a horse, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah, in 1988, just doing a scene in the film The Return of the Musketeers, and the horse lost its footing on the bridge that they'd been asked to ride over, despite the stuntman saying that it was too dangerous. And, his horse's hoof had slipped on the cobbled bridge, and he fell off and broke his pelvis and then bled to death over the next 24 hours in a Spanish hospital that wasn't quite aware of what to do. But I was 10 at the time, which actually is, for these things to happen, you are fairly resilient. It's obviously later on in life that those things come back to affect you probably more. When I was about 14, 15, and then again at the age of 20, when I'd lived half of my life without him, as I both had sort of moments of I guess reigniting grief, and I always turned to music to offer me solace at that time. Yeah.
The next piece I think you've chosen partially because we were talking with the trumpet about control, and in this slow movement of a Beethoven violin sonata, I think you feel that it is that element of control in the music and in the performance, probably, that is fascinating.
Yes, both in the performance, but musically, the sense in which, particularly in the middle section, you are at times almost overwhelmed by the beauty of what's being played, and it always retracts just at the point of overwhelming you. I think that sense of control over your audience, as well as what you're doing, and that sense of steeliness which it displays, that at the point of overwhelming tears, you pull back and say, "No, I'm just going to carry on again." I guess I find that quite moving, and something that is particularly English, I think, despite coming from a German composer.
We heard there Yehudi Menuhin playing the slow movement Adagio Espressivo from the violin sonata No. 10 in G, opus 96, known as the Cockcrow. Glenn Gould was the pianist, and I did feel that they brought something new, almost, because of the pairing of those two musicians.
There's a great tension, I mean, not in a negative way, in a forward-looking way, in both their playings independently, so brought together. I find they just work off each other so successfully.
And there's another quality, apart from the one I mentioned, which I think is that, and this also makes me think of your acting, which is that less is more. I mean, you often are spoken of as somebody who is able to convey a suppressed emotion. And that is very much a hallmark of what you do, I think.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's... And it's certainly not something I've set out to do, but it's probably just an extension of my own personality, probably.
Well, there's also a very clear focus on text. Let's just listen to a little bit of your Hamlet at the National Theatre.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Or that the Everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. Oh, God! God! How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie upon it. Ah, fie, 'tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this. But 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion to a satyr. So loving to my mother that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth, must I remember?
The use of space is very musical there too. Of course, it's such wonderful language. Did you have to sort of work very hard getting into that character, getting inside the language, because it's so jewel-encrusted, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's... I guess when working on Shakespeare, I mean, particularly something with Hamlet, where the poetry is so remarkable, I mean, less so with Iago, his language is a lot more functional. But with Hamlet, you do, in some ways, need to think about how your language is landing. And how an audience, particularly a 21st century audience, receives it. And that's obviously working out the rhetoric of the speeches, but also giving the time for language to land and to be processed. Not that you say every line and wait for them to catch up, and sometimes an audience having to run along slightly to catch up with you is a good thing. But you, I guess as an actor, you don't want people to miss out on the riches, particularly a speech like I have of late, but wherever I know not, lost all my mirth. I mean, moved me almost every time I said it, you know, so in some ways it's very, very easy to say because the poetry of it is just so piercingly acute and just wounds the heart every time you say it. In some ways it was just a question of don't get in the way and make sure the clarity is there for an audience.
We're going to hear some jazz next. And one might think that the improvisational quality of jazz would make it something just totally unlike what we've just been talking about, Shakespeare, except that those silences, that listening to other people, finding the poetry in the improvisation, there are analogies even there.
The fun thing is, you know, that's why we do it night after night, is that people bring, in some ways, their days to the evening performance. Things break down, people forget lines. There's the excitement of live theatre that an audience reacts to, and an audience loves it when they can sense things are different or changing or going wrong. It just feels to me exactly like jazz, particularly that you're all working within a framework and structure that is set down, and then people are allowed to be as free as possible within that.
You heard quite a bit of jazz at home, didn't you? I think it was your mum that particularly liked jazz.
My mum had been out with a jazz pianist for a long time before she met my dad, and so she'd had an education in it. And this album, Concert by the Sea, Eragonus, was one of the first jazz albums I heard. And I still don't think I've heard a better album in terms of spontaneity of playing within the rigidity of his technique and his ability. It feels, I guess, what you hope you and strive for as an actor, that you have such a solid framework and grounding in what you're doing, and then it entirely is down to instinct and imagination. That is the slice of pure happiness that is Cole Porter's It's All Right By Me, played by the peerless Errol Garner from Concert by the Sea, his 1955 live album.
I love the way he wrapped up that coda so emphatically.
Yeah, and you just know that musically, and the maths of music is so ingrained in him, he knows it so well that he can grant himself such freedom because he knows when to come back.
You mentioned the way music helped you deal with difficult times in your life, grief and that sort of thing. And in fact, when you were a teenager, it was playing the piano, wasn't it?
Mm. There were times in my life that I entirely self-medicated by piano, which I guess is not too bad a way to self-medicate.
What kind of medicine are you taking at the moment?
Musically, in the sort of last 5 or 6 years, I've become very much more interested in the music of Eastern and Central Europe from the early 20th century up to sort of late 20th century. I guess it started with Shostakovich and moving on through that And the next piece is by Bartok, and...
And it's another slow movement.
Yes, there's probably a part of me that that naturally attunes himself to the second movement of three of pieces. I don't know if that's probably, an incipient melancholy on me that I haven't been able to shake. But I do like being moved by music and, I guess, sometimes moved to tears. I don't shy away from that, and I think it's sometimes quite a good thing to have a cry, because it probably needs to go somewhere, that feeling, and crying it out's probably not too bad. And I guess it's quite nice to do it to something as beautiful as this.
Thank you.
I love about that music is the way the protagonist, the piano, gradually cajoles the orchestra into joining in. At first they seem rather separate. And of course there's also Bartok's love of night sounds and insects and sort of rather weird little oscillations.
Yes, I guess learning, I guess from pieces like this, learning how orchestras can replicate life. I mean, I always find it remarkable how, I guess, how ridiculous music is in the sense of people sitting down with bits of wood and metal, and that they can not only pierce your heart but tell stories just as credibly and legibly and comprehensibly as you try and do as an actor with words that everybody speaks.
We heard, by the way, a wonderful pianist, Jean-Eflamme Bavouzet, playing with the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Gianandrea Noseda, in the slow movement Adagio Religioso of Bartok's Piano Concerto No. 3. I was excited when I saw, Rory, that you'd chosen Schnittke, composer that we don't often hear on this programme. He sadly died rather young, but he had that kind of polystylistic personality of a lot of Russian composers and then began to narrow it down, I think. He became a convert, a religious convert, didn't he? That seems to have, rather like Arvo Pärt, he seemed to react against what he'd been doing himself.
Yeah, I mean, Schnittke's later works do have a piece to them in terms of form and content, which I guess is a good advertisement for getting older.
Thank you.
the fourth movement of the choir concerto by Alfred Schnittke, a setting of 10th century Armenian poetry that he wrote in 1984, 2 years after he converted to Catholicism. And it does have that kind of vision to it, doesn't it? That somebody here has seen a light.
You get why religion is so attractive, but the way that the music at the end swells and moves, and because he populates it not just with the four parts of a choir, but with so many other different voices, as the waves build and crash, as lots of music does. But you can sort of see the sticks and stones and seaweed in all the waves as well. But that sense of moving towards an enlightened goal, a final point.
Now, music, as we've said, can get through to people where other things can't, and you clearly find it very cathartic when you've had problems in your life. For instance, your older sister, Karina, was born with very severe disabilities owing to a lack of oxygen at birth. And music is central to your relationship with her, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, she has an extraordinary capacity to respond to music, and it's given her, you know, other than her family and day trips out and walks and roller coasters, probably the sort of the greatest happiness in her life comes from music. And obviously we've been able to, as a family, develop that. It started with nursery rhymes, and the more familiar she is with something, the more it tends to put her at her ease and the more she tends to enjoy it. There was a time when we'd all be sat around the dinner table when we were growing up, and when the EastEnders theme tune came on, she used to break out into hysterical laughter. She just loved the EastEnders theme tune for, I don't know why. It's a very good theme tune. I've been able to compose a few songs for her and record them for her, so that, you know, if I'm not able to see her as much as I'd like, she is at least being able to still, I guess, engage with me as her brother. And you do sort of see its ability to transcend the what we see as the traditional workings of the brain, that we all, no matter what our difficulties or way we understand and comprehend life, that we are all seemingly able to be pierced by music. And it comes down to just enjoying a loud bang or a balloon popping or hitting a keyboard of a piano to, you know, hearing this next piece of music, which is from a CD that is played an awful lot. And any nurse that looks after Karina for more than 3 days will come away humming this song because they will probably hear it about 5 or 6 times a day.
Oh, the buzzing of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain, where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain. On a summer's day in the month of May, a burly bum come a-hiking down a shady lane near the sugar cane. He was looking for his liking. As he strolled along, he sung a song of a land of milk and honey, where a bum can stay for many a day, and he won't need any money. Oh, 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 the buzzing of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain, where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain. In the big rock candy mountain, the cops have wooden legs, the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmers' trees are full of fruit, the barns are full of hay. I want to go where there ain't no snow, where the sleet don't fall and the wind don't blow, in that big rock candy mountain. Oh, the buzzing of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain, where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain. Oh, 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 oh. The buzz. of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain.
And that was Burl Ives singing Big Rock Candy Mountain.
It's charming. I can see
it's
why
an incredibly sweet voice for such a big man as well.
Talking about Carina, your first play has just opened in London, Rory. It's called The Herd, and by that I mean it's the first play you have written. And it's really clearly got some of these family experiences in it. And there's a son who's about to turn 21, like your sister, profound disabilities. I went and saw it, Shepherd's Bush, and found it both touching and very funny. And of course, that's what people forget sometimes, isn't it? That everything in life has its almost black comedy to it.
I guess, you know, in every moment of great, great trauma and tragedy, things become funnier because, I guess, it feels illicit. And it's also so happily seized upon as to take you out of it. I mean, I think that's in a lot of writing and in a lot of music as well, that when you're brought down to the depths, the shining star of humour, which I guess can be used to deaden the feelings. Kierkegaard said jokes are the epitaphs on the death of feelings. I think also in families, particularly families going through things that might be stressful, it bonds them together very, very tightly. And also, to get through it, you develop a way of talking to each other which is at once direct and forthright, which can be funny to an outsider because no one holds back with what they say to each other. And also develop, quite a black sense of humour. And both my parents were very funny. My mum still is very funny. And my sister as well. So and Carina has a great love of the absurd.
Apart from playwriting, you've got quite a few busy months. You're playing Lord Lucan in an ITV drama series and filming a movie about codebreaker Alan Turing. But you're more and more drawn, I notice, to working with music and musicians. Indeed, your final choice features Mark Padmore, who you've worked with on more than one occasion.
Yes, I was fortunate enough to meet Mark through Vicky Mortimer, who is his wife and who has designed five or six of the shows that I've done at the National, and is a good friend. And Mark invited me down to the Endelian Festival that he now is the artistic director of down in Cornwall, which is a festival for both professional and amateur musicians to come together over a period of a fortnight and just to play as much music as they'd like. You know, to be able to see Mark try out different things. I hope he's not listening, but he has the kind of voice that when he starts singing, I don't want him to stop.
And he is marvellous singing Bach, of course. I've seen him as the evangelist, and it's a Bach cantata you've chosen.
Yes, and, you know, there was part of me that thought maybe I'd just choose eight Bach pieces when I first came across this, because it's the kind of composer that encapsulates all of the world. And I think, you know, Mark himself has said if he could only do one thing for the rest of his life, it would be sing Bach.
Well, it's an aria from Liebestergott, the Bach cantata. Which one is it?
It's Was willst du dich?
Well, Rory, thank you very much for being my guest today and introducing me to such a fascinating collection of pieces.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute delight.
Was willst du dich, mein Geist entsetzen, wenn meine letzte Stunde schlägt? Was willst du dich, mein Geist? Mark Padmore singing Bach's Cantata No. 8 with the English Baroque Soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. Michael Barclay was talking to the actor Rory Kinnear. And you might like to know you can download that episode and others in the series if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and Private Passions is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Next Sunday at midday, Michael's guest is the writer Lucy Hughes Hallett.
Italy is a divided country. The Italian equivalent in some ways of the word nationalism is the word campanilismo, from the Italian word for bell tower, campanile. And so it indicates that the loyalty, the attachment of most Italians is to their bell tower, to the thousands of cities and towns and villages.
A story of fragmentation, foreign occupation and nationalist false starts. Misha Glenny presents The Invention of Italy, starting tomorrow at 8 on BBC Radio 4.
Well, if you've recently tuned in, a warm welcome to you from me, Jonathan Swain, on this cold and soggy Sunday afternoon in this part of the world anyway. Looking ahead, and here on Radio 3 in an hour's time, there's the early music show Lucy Skeeping, introducing a selection of music inspired by Greek mythology. That's from 2 o'clock. And before it, in just a couple of minutes, our Sunday lunchtime concert, String Quartets by Schumann and Shostakovich. First, though, at 1 o'clock, a summary of the BBC News. Disaster relief agencies have begun moving into parts of eastern India devastated by Cyclone Palin. I beg your pardon, Cyclone Pilin. Thousands of homes have been demolished and power lines torn down across the estates of Orissa and Andhra Pradesh. It's thought that one of the biggest evacuations in the country's history limited the loss of life. Indian police say at least 60 people have been killed in a stampede at a Hindu religious festival in the central state of Madhya Pradesh. About 100 others were injured in the incident, which police say was caused by a rumour that a bridge over the river Sindh was about to collapse. The Chancellor George Osborne has arrived in China to begin a week-long trade mission to promote British business. Speaking in Beijing, he said an £800 million deal involving Chinese companies and the owners of Manchester Airport would create one of the biggest building projects seen in Britain since the construction of the Olympic Park. The new Shadow Education Secretary, Tristram Hunt, has signalled a shift in Labour's approach to free schools and expressed regret for dismissing them in the past as a vanity project for yummy mummies. Mr. Hunt confirmed that a Labour government would keep what he called the good free schools and introduce its own version called parent-led academies. The Energy Secretary, Ed Davey, says a deal to build more nuclear reactors in Britain is extremely close. The French firm EDF wants to build two new reactors at Hinkley Point in Somerset. Mr. Davey said there may be an announcement in Parliament soon. British detectives investigating the disappearance of Madeleine McCann in Portugal 6 years ago say the accepted version of events has significantly changed. Scotland Yard will make a new appeal for information about what happened to the three-year-old girl on the BBC's Crime Watch programme tomorrow night. And finally, the weather. It'll remain unsettled this afternoon across England and Wales, with rain and strong winds affecting most areas. It'll be drier and brighter in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Top temperatures of 13 Celsius in London, 12 Celsius in Cardiff and Belfast, and 11 Celsius in Edinburgh. And that's the news and the weather with the time at 2.5 minutes past one. So to today's Radio 3 lunchtime concert, one from the City of London Festival a few years ago. This one happened at the interestingly named City Church of St. Vidast, alias Foster. The musicians, also interestingly named, the Finnish string quartet Meta 4, Meta, then the figure 4. Three pieces in their concert at the centre, a work Meta 4 commissioned from the Brazilian saxophonist Felipe Sales. After it, the third of Robert Schumann's string quartets. And first of all here, well, if Shostakovich's 15 symphonies are like a musical thread passing through his public life, his cycle of 15 string quartets very much represents the private side to the man. And this is the seventh of the Shostakovich quartets, a piece from 1960 sparked off by the death of his first wife, Nina. By all accounts, this seventh quartet was one of Shostakovich's own favourites among his 15.